Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
You and I are living in a divided country, separated from our fellow citizens by income, race, education, and worldview. But here's a fascinating detail. While poor Black and Latino Americans face hardships equivalent to or worse than their white peers, minority Americans seem better equipped to cope with those problems, especially in certain parts of the country. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Carol Graham is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and College Park professor at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. You can find a link to her recent report for Brookings, The Geography of Desperation in America, at think.kera.org. It's a continuation of her ongoing investigation into diversity, resilience, and optimism in the face of poverty, and it finds significant differences among U.S. states in terms of how its lowest income citizens feel, which can translate to differences in how and even how long they live. Carol, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Before we talk about the impact of place, I want to talk about what you've learned about the differences in experience among poor Americans depending on race. First of all, what counts as poor for purposes of this research?
Right. Well, we use the Gallup poll data. I'm an advisor to Gallup and therefore have access to the data. And it's a very detailed data set on 1,000 Americans a day from 2008 through today. So it's large, very detailed. It includes extensive income data. And we define poverty as the lowest fifth of the distribution, which is about $24,000 a year for a household of four, which in turn corresponds very closely with the official U.S. poverty line. So poverty in our data corresponds roughly with official measures.
What led you to believe there might be differences by race in how resilient different groups of Americans would be?
Well, I have to say I fell into that finding, and it surprised me when I first found it. And then the more I read and understood and tried to learn, it makes a lot more sense. But I was looking at differences across the rich and the poor in Latin America, comparing those differences to the rich and the poor in the United States, because I was very concerned about how divided the U.S. was. And I'm originally from Latin America, and I have done a ton of work on poor people in poor countries around the world. And it struck me that the poor in the U.S. were significantly more stressed than the poor in Latin America. They were significantly less likely to smile in a day, which is just a measure of positive affect or mood. And the most striking finding was that they were significantly less likely to believe that hard work would get them ahead. And the difference between the rich and the poor on that question is 20 times greater in the U.S. than it is in Latin America. In other words, the gap is that much bigger when you compare the gap between rich and poor in the U.S. and rich and poor in Latin America. And that really struck me, that my hunch that we were very divided, and that played out not only in incomes and opportunities, but in attitudes and in well-being. It really struck me that there was something to this. So I decided to go into detail on how did this differ across poor groups in the U.S., and I compared poor Blacks, poor Whites, and poor Hispanics being the main groups. It's not to ignore other groups, but it's just what was feasible technically. And it was about the time of the Ferguson riots and the Baltimore riots. So this is mid-2015. It was a time of a lot of concern about the state of the African American community, police violence issues, other things. And so I went into this expecting that I'd probably get high levels of optimism on poor Hispanics. I'm from Latin America, and Latin Americans always score higher than their incomes would predict on most well-being metrics. I thought I'd get a neutral on poor Whites and a sort of negative in comparison on optimism for poor Blacks. And instead, I got absolutely the opposite findings. The most positive group of all the poor groups by far were poor Blacks. The second most positive were poor Hispanics, and then very, very, very far behind were poor Whites. And so I was initially puzzled and, you know, checked the data, as it's usually do when you get a finding that's unusual. And then around the same time, the data on premature mortality came out based on CDC data showing that our mortality rate is being driven up by preventable deaths among middle-aged, uneducated whites. That was a first take on that mortality story. And I realized that the mortality data and my data were telling a very similar story about surprising levels of desperation and lack of hope among poor whites. And since then, I've looked very closely in it in two ways. One, trying to understand high levels of minority resilience, and I can talk more to that if that's of interest, but also in terms of what was going on with poor whites, links to the opioid crisis, all kinds of other things. And one thing we did that I think confirmed that our metrics and the mortality metrics are telling the same story is we matched our data at the individual level and at the Metropolitan Statistical Association level, our data on lack of hope, stress, anger, and pain with the mortality rate data, and found indeed that the mortality rate data very much corresponded with the patterns we found among the same people, the same demographic traits, the same places.
I want to talk just a little bit more about hope here, because optimism might sound like a nice thing to have, but not necessarily vital to a decent life. You point out that you're not likely to invest in your future in the form of taking care of your health or getting education or going for that extra bit of job training if you don't believe things are likely to get any better regardless of what you do.
Absolutely. And we found this. I found this pattern in the early days of when we were using well-being metrics and studying life satisfaction, happiness in the early 2000s, that people who believed in their future, who were optimistic about their future mobility, were much more likely to invest in their health and invest in the labor market, invest in their education, and bingo, they did better. Since then, that work has been confirmed by experiments on twins, all kinds of things. So that's health studies, longevity studies. So people who have higher levels of well-being and who are more optimistic not only live longer, but they tend to do better. And one of the things that is very striking about these data is that the variable that most closely links in the mortality rate patterns is lack of hope. Stress is also a definite marker of ill-being, and that also links with the mortality rate data. But lack of hope has the strongest link. And most recently, we've been doing some experimental work, as have some others, on interventions that increase or provide hope for very poor respondents in Latin America and Africa. And the finding seemed to be that, the provision of hope for people who have, limited reason to have hope but are given one seems to change their outlook and often their behavior and then their trajectory. So it's not a magic bullet, but it's very clear that lack of hope and desperation are linked to bad outcomes, and we're seeing, I think, the worst kind of that outcome in terms of the opioid crisis, the mortality rate crisis.
Yeah, we heard just today that the White House commission that's looking at the opioid crisis has asked the president to declare this a national emergency. It is a problem. One thing that you found was that working class whites report more physical pain than their peers of color. Is it too much of a leap to say this might be a factor in why opioid addiction is a particular scourge among working class white Americans?
The crisis is sort of a perfect storm in that there is a crisis of work among working class white Americans. Mm. And if you look at the places where their jobs were most stable locationally and industrially, it was the heartland, it was coal mines or car manufacturing. These are typically, heavy labor, blue-collar jobs that often come with injuries or, long-term effects on backs and knees and other things. And those are the industries that are being hollowed out, both by technology-driven growth and some by import competition, but really mainly by technology-driven growth. So in the same places where you have a lot of people who are losing their prospects of future employment, and their kids are as well, you have a lot of people who are on disability insurance and have lots of job-related whether it's chronic illnesses or whatever, and do report a lot of pain. Pain, opioids in this country are prescribed very easily. We have the highest per capita consumption in the world of opioids, which is pretty remarkable. And so pain seems to be a gateway both to opioids, and then when opioids run out, people often switch to available black market synthetic drugs like fentanyl, which are deadly. Mm-hmm. So there's a link to from pain to opioids to overdose and suicide. That's part of it. The other part of the story, which seems to resonate with the higher levels of resilience stories, is that just in general, whites report more pain than do blacks or Hispanics. And then if you just look at cross low-income whites, rural whites are more likely to report pain than urban poor whites, and that probably has to do with the kind of work they do and their likelihood of being injured or having chronic back injuries or other sorts of similar injuries. If you look at a map of disability insurance, it matches these patterns locationally and cohort-wise.
Were you able to factor out the possibility of any cultural difference that might make whites more likely to acknowledge physical pain than their peers of color? You know, people don't complain at the same levels necessarily.
Right, and I've found that everywhere. For example, often you'll find if you're looking at data on health and poverty, you know, across a range of poor countries, it depends on them. If for example, you use, you know, days of missed work as an indicator of ill health, mm-hmm. you don't find anything on poor people because they go to work when they're sick. They don't go to work when they can't get out of bed.
Because otherwise they don't get paid. Right.
Right. And so that may translate into this same differential levels of resilience, adaptation to tougher lives story, which is part of the minority story. There may also just be more, part of the resilience story is clearly that minorities in different ways, both blacks and Hispanics, seem to have stronger levels of family and community support, playing out slightly differently across the groups, but, you know, somebody to rely on when you're in need or, to, you know. So that may be a coping mechanism, a quite effective one indeed. And yes, it just may be more acceptable for whites to report more pain. Maybe they're more likely to go to the doctor and report pain and therefore get opioids. That's another possibility. But this, our data is just simply on reported pain in the Gallup surveys, and it demonstrates that pattern as well.
Do you have reason to believe that the difference in white resilience as compared with black and Latino resilience is a new phenomenon?
I think the sort of threatened identity of the white working class is a new-ish phenomenon. I think it's been around for a lot longer than we think. It didn't start in 2015. And in fact, if we'd been using well-being metrics on a regular basis, we probably would have picked up on it a lot sooner. And that's been, I'd say, like a 20-year trend of sort of the increasingly fragile labor market. Trends in marriage, for example, used to be very much a racial difference phenomenon. It was blacks versus whites in terms of marriage rates. Now it's rich versus poor, and the white, you know, the sort of Ozzie and Harriet stable white middle class household just doesn't exist anymore.
My guest is Carol Graham. She's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and College Park professor in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. We're talking about her report, The Geography of Desperation in America. You can join us at 800-933-5372.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Brookings Institution senior fellow Carol Graham, who is College Park professor at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. You can check out a link to her new report, The Geography of Desperation in America. We have a link to it at think.kera.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Carol, you note that poor Blacks and Latinos tend to see themselves as doing better than their parents and grandparents before them, even if they are still struggling. Poor whites tend to believe they're doing worse. Is this demonstrably true?
That they're actually doing worse?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It's demonstrably true in the aggregate, obviously. You know, looking at the aggregate trends I've been talking about, the sort of hollowed out manufacturing sectors, the decline of coal mining, the decline of the stable blue-collar family, all of those things are, in the aggregate, very clear trends that demonstrate that things are worse than they used to be. You know, are they materially worse off? They probably have maybe one more car or one more television than their parents did, but they're definitely worse off in terms of prospects of where they're going, in terms of the stability of their employment, for example. And they're also worse off in relative status terms. So it used to be that in the chain of things that blue-collar whites had the advantage in getting the stable, you know, higher quality blue-collar jobs over minorities. And that's less and less the case as we've made, I think, you know, very important strides against discrimination in the labor market. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but there's definitely been progress. You know, that advantage is no longer there. And at the same time, as you noted with the first part of that statement, minorities are making gradual, hard-fought progress. So life expectancy gaps are narrowing, education gaps are narrowing, and there's been a sort of a downward mobility of sorts for blue-collar whites at the same time. So there's kind of a relative story and an absolute story, and neither are very optimistic for poor whites.
All right. I want to talk now about the role that place might play in all of this. Poor minorities are the least optimistic in states like California, Washington, Oregon, Kansas, and New Mexico. The pattern for whites is nearly the opposite. So how do you take that data and begin to make sense of what it means?
Right. And I can't answer every single question on this because, we're trying to understand something that's very difficult to observe without going to every place, right? But so what we did, it's maybe important to explain how we did this. In isolating the role of place, we controlled for income, socioeconomic status, employment status, health status, extent of people who were living with deprivation, education, religion, pretty much everything else that might play a role in determining optimism or worry or reported pain. And then having done that, we compared poor minorities, so we combined blacks and Hispanics, to poor whites in different places, right? And we just looked at the extent to which their scores on these optimism, worry, and pain questions were in addition, there were differences across place. So it really is an attempt to the extent we could, really specifically look at place. And as I think about the findings for minorities, California, I think, is it's a very unequal state, and at some level racially segregated. That may have part to do with it. I think the high levels of inequality certainly make minorities more likely to be worried because, it's even harder to keep, get where you want to get. It may also be the nature of jobs, a lot of immigrant labor, a lot of agricultural labor jobs. I think that's an issue, I think, probably also in New Mexico. In some of the other states like Washington State and Kansas, I think it's just that there are just not many minorities. So when you look at the places that minorities are the most optimistic, which is the southern corridor, not Florida, not Texas, but all those other southern states, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, there are quite a lot of minorities. And in particular, I think a strong sense of black culture in a lot of these places that plays a role. Again, remember, we're just trying to explain the role of place, all these other things have been factored out. And then when you look at the story for poor whites, they are least optimistic and most worried and more likely to report pain in the exact same regions I was talking about earlier, the regions where in the heartland of the country where manufacturing's hollowed out, coal mining has declined, and there's a high concentration of blue-collar whites in bad straits. One of the things that we found when we matched the mortality rate data was that places that were more diverse, more racially diverse, more urban, were much less likely to have these high mortality rates. In part, that's because minorities are less likely to report depression or commit suicide, but in part, in these concentrations of that combination of hollowed out employment, not very strong community structures, big distance and lack of diversity. You know, living with a lot of desperation around you is probably not very good for your own optimism.
We had your colleague from Brookings, Richard Reeves, on a couple of weeks ago talking about, the way he defines the biggest problem with the income gap is the gap between the upper middle class and everybody else. Did you find that poor whites are more likely than poor blacks and Latinos to sort of compare up to other white people who make up a significant percentage of the upper middle class?
I think, I wish I had perfect data on that, mm-hmm. and I don't. But I think that yes, for poor whites, they don't want to compare themselves to poor minorities. They want to compare themselves to other whites who are doing better. I mean, that's what the way it used to be, right? And now, on the one hand, you've got sort of minorities clearly catching up, doing better, and on the other, the top of the white distribution is pulling very, very far away from these people. They're educationally, income-wise, aspiration-wise, they're very, very, their lives are very, very far from the lives of the upper middle class.
I'm curious about the challenge of when you were looking at people's experience of physical pain. Did you have to control for the effects of healthcare availability to working class Americans in different states? Were you able to do that?
We controlled for reported self-reported health, mm-hmm. so their state of health. We did not control for access to healthcare, although. Access. One thing that we do find in the data is not having health insurance is significantly and very negatively associated with well-being, whether it be stress or life satisfaction or optimism. It's not a good thing.
All right. I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also find us on Twitter at KERA Think. Let's speak with Bo in Royce City. Hi, Bo.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go right ahead, please.
Okay. I want to know if stress contributes to heart disease and specifically arrhythmia of the heart and early death from heart attacks.
Well, Carol's not a physician, but maybe you can speak in general terms to stress and health, Carol.
Certainly. Stress is clearly a marker of ill health. And it's a good question because in this whole sort of cocktail, which is not really the right word, of conditions that are driving up our mortality rate. In addition to the sort of deaths of despair, drug overdose and suicide, there's also been an increase in two kinds of preventable deaths, and one is lung disease, lung cancer, which is a behaviorally driven condition, right? It's clearly linked to smoking, right? And so certainly lack of hope in the future probably reflects also high levels of stress. And then the other is heart disease, which is not totally, but is also often linked to behaviors such as healthy eating and exercise and other things. And we found, again, when we looked more generally at the mortality rate patterns and the well-being patterns locationally, that places with higher rates of mortality were less likely to have, were at a lower percentage of respondents who exercised and a higher percentage of respondents who smoked. So stress is often a channel in that, although, you know, I can't isolate causality. As you said, I'm not a physician, but it's a marker of ill-being that's very clearly associated with heart disease.
You alluded to this briefly earlier, but I wonder if you can speak in more depth about the pros and cons to low-income people of all races of living in racially diverse communities.
It seems, at least in our data, and I think almost just as an observational finding as well, that more diverse communities, which typically tend to be peri-urban or, you know, suburban around a big city, rather than very isolated in the heartland, are indeed healthier, happier places. I mean, our data show that. And then what explains that? That's a more difficult thing. I think the diversity of different kinds of communities, I think the positive effects of just interacting with people who aren't like you. You get used to it. It's normal, right? And the typically also these places they're just far less isolated. So in addition to the hollowing out of jobs in the heartland, where I think the particularly for white males, the car factory or the coal mine were actually not just a job. It's where you went every day. It was your community. Mm. There are less informal communities. And one reason for that, I mean, I'm sure there are many, is literally distance and climate. You know, things are far away from each other, right? You have to drive everywhere. There aren't sort of vibrant little town centers and city centers, or not many of them. And everything's far. So the sort of, you know, kind of innate community that comes out of people sitting around, a village square or whatever, is just very difficult to find in these, you know, places with big distances and either incredible cold or incredible heat, which characterizes a lot of the Midwest anyway.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Carol Graham of the Brookings Institution and the University of Maryland, where she is College Park Professor at the School of Public Policy. We're talking about her report, The Geography of Desperation in America. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. I know, Carol, that it was not part of this study, but you will be aware of maybe similar studies that have looked at this. How different do you think the outcomes would be if you had tried to separate out responses according to sex? Are women doing better than men or vice versa?
I think that, you know, in relative terms, women are, no, in absolute terms, women are doing better. So their mortality rate is lower. But in terms of the changes, their mortality rate, starting from a lower rate, has had a higher percentage increase in this category of deaths of despair. Hmm. So there's a lot, and I think the opioid crisis has a lot to do with that. That is part of the story. Men seem to have worse outcomes on the mortality rate levels because I think particularly for and also employment rates, there are the sort of percent of prime age males out of the labor force is a large concern in this whole story. It's at about 15% of prime age males are out of the labor force now, projected to go up to 25% in the next couple of decades. That's a lot of, you know, potentially working men who are not working in their prime age years. Women are just, maybe because they have to be, innately better multitaskers. They're more likely to take jobs in the service industry. There are health sector jobs available. Blue-collar white males don't see themselves doing those jobs, and they don't take them. And so women may just have a broader range of coping skills and a broader range of identity. You know, their identity is less likely to be only being, not only, but very strongly associated with being a coal miner or a car, you know, working in a car factory or whatever it might be. They're also equally likely to be mothers or, you know, whatever else. So I think if you look across gender, the story is hardly perfect for particularly white women, but it's better.
Why have marriage rates dropped off among lower-income Americans and remained stable against better-educated, wealthier Americans? What's going on there?
So two things. One is, to use a cumbersome term, assortative mating. So people, as women have entered the labor market, what happens is higher skilled women choose higher skilled men and higher skilled men choose higher skilled or educated women. So you get it. That also increases our income inequality because you get these, you know, high-powered
high-skilled career couples.
And that makes it, you know, there are challenges, but it's a lot easier to run a household if you've got enough means versus at the low income end of the skill sort of distribution and income distribution, you have this issue of prime age males dropping out of the labor force. So you have a lot of unemployed men. And if you, now that women can work and get educated, why get married to somebody who's just going to be a drag, right? There's a lot of sort of there's some literature on the lack of sort of available or marriage attractive males at that and in this same cohort, and then also just the likelihood of stress and the challenges associated with unemployment, low income, making it harder to keep marriages together is also part of that story.
My guest is Carol Graham. We're talking about her report for the Brookings Institution called The Geography of Desperation in America. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Carol Graham of the Brookings Institution. We're talking about her new report that looks at the geography of desperation in America. It considers measures of well-being among white, Latino, and Black Americans and finds that overall, low-income white Americans are doing worse than their low-income Black and Latino peers. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You've noted before, Carol, that stress hurts more than money helps in terms of overall happiness and well-being. What does that suggest about potential remedies to help people in troubled communities?
Well, that's the $1,000, right. $100,000 question, of course. I mean, I've obviously thought a lot about this. One way to think about this difficult problem is to look at communities that have made improvements. And they usually take kind of a whole range of solutions. There's a very poor town in West Virginia. I think it's called Huntington, West Virginia. I may have the name wrong. But that was like one of the poorest towns in the country. And through a combination of the mayor's office and the private sector and the community, they came up with a strategy that included infrastructure investment, but community renovation, some skills training for unemployed former coal miners, and they made a big dent in the state of their community. So it strikes me that, you know, we've talked a lot about place, that there are the community, that the place where people live can make a huge difference. The other sort of moving tectonic plate solutions are education, education, and education. For one, we're not going to retrain, 55-year-old retired coal miners or auto factory workers to work in the high skills sector and move to Silicon Valley. But we have to train their children. You know, traditionally in the past, when jobs left states like, say, the Dakotas, which used to be much more populated centuries ago than they are today, people left and went to where the jobs were. The problem now is that it's not just location, but it's also the skills distribution of jobs. And the booming parts of our economy are on the coast, Silicon Valley, or pretty much the coast of the country where you've got a lot of high-tech industry. So that next generation needs to get high-skilled education to be able to move up, and they need to be willing to move. So that's part of the story. The other part of the story, in addition to education and education and education, is health, health, and health. Mm-hmm. And that includes having health insurance, which we seem to be going backwards on, which is, just really unfathomable from a social responsibility point of view. But also that we do need to deal in a serious way with the opioid crisis. And that includes not just the demand part of that story, which is, how opioids are prescribed and the supply of them. The supply side, but the demand side. And the demand side comes from desperation and lack of hope. And that's a tougher call. How do you restore that? And again, we need to think a lot about communities that have managed to revive somehow. And that may also be kind of a retooling in terms of what is it that people are doing, particularly older, out-of-the-labor-force people. And one of the things that shows up again and again in well-being studies based on communities in Britain, for example, is that things like volunteering, participating in community activities are really, really good for well-being, particularly elderly people's well-being. So, on the one end of the age scale, you have to think about retooling and educating and possibly retraining. But on the sort of other end of the age scale, you have to think about, what could we do to improve the state of some communities and possibly provide people with lessons from other communities about how things have gotten better when, they participated communally in revitalization activities. So this is not a straightforward, easy, magic bullet story, but I think there are things that can be done and there are lessons from other places. And given the state of things in a lot of our country now, I think we need to look outside of our box for things that have worked.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we have Patty on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Patty.
Hello. I grew up in a border town that was 99% Mexican American. I myself am an American of Mexican descent, and a majority of my classmates from high school, which was a large high school with a population of over 600 graduating class, attended and graduated from four-year universities, got advanced degrees, etc. I was very surprised in coming to the DFW area, working with the youth, that at the lack of academic challenges that a lot of them had, the lack of volunteerism, and really the thought that a lot of them had that they just were never going to attend college. And these were kids and young adults who were of Mexican-American, but other ethnicities as well. I was very surprised because I always assumed that attending school in a large district and having more diversity and et cetera was going to create better opportunity. And I know that's not the case everywhere, but can you talk a little bit about that? Because that was a dichotomy that I did not expect. And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, that's an important observation and also a great question. And again, that is often this unexplainable, difficult to observe role of particular places. I don't know what the college admissions process is like in the DFW area versus the small border towns. I do know a lot about the aspirations of first and second generation migrants. And often you'll see that the first generation is very driven to succeed. You know, they've made huge sacrifices to move, and often, you know, push or transmit those aspirations to their children, and that tends to be a really positive force. And then, for some reason, there are more second generation kids that tend to be a little bit less hopeful, less confident they'll get ahead. You know, if you started as a poor migrant or the children of poor migrants, then your reference group is where you started, and things could get better and do get better. But often the second generation migrants' kids, you know, their initial starting point is kind of where they are compared to other people in America. And that may be affected by inequality. There may be perceived racial discrimination. I don't know enough about the Dallas-Fort Worth area, although I know your airport very well. That's not exactly a great data point. So it's, you know, again, it just suggests that the story is more complicated than, you know, the aggregate story that's in the data trends, and also that it varies a lot by place. One just last sort of observation on that question. If you look at social mobility rates around the country, a study by Raj Chetty and co-authors showed that they vary tremendously by place, and that, for example, San Jose, California is one of the places with the highest rates of social mobility, and Cleveland, Ohio is one of the lowest. And there are many reasons for that story, but one of them is Cleveland is historically one of the most traditionally racially segregated cities in the country, and San Jose is full of diversity and migrants and very integrated. Then there's also the nature of industry, the nature of education, something that my colleague Richard Reeves has actually written about, which is how as we segregate into upper middle income neighborhoods, that provides educational segregation just in terms of school quality. And, you know, if you go to a top quality public school, your odds of going to a college and a good college are much higher than if you go to a low quality public school. And that trend or that dichotomy is very much aggravated by racial and other kinds of segregation in many places in the country.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Carol Graham of the Brookings Institution. We're talking about her recent report, The Geography of Desperation in America. Let's go back to the phones now and speak with Jeff in Denton. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay, I find this fascinating. I work with kids in the care of the state, and they come from various backgrounds, various ages, and I kind of had a question, but after listening, I kind of have more of an observation, I guess, because you've answered a lot of the questions I had. But it seems to me that individuals, based on their race and their age, although they do have an ethnic background, it seems to be their perceived access to resources, and then also if they can be in an environment that does promote exploration of their skill set and their talents, it seems that they do have to kind of move away from whatever expectations they had and maybe be more successful depending on their input and their environment.
Well, that's a great observation, and I would love to hear more about your work, which sounds both interesting and admirable. I think you're right. I mean, I think that that may be part of what explains the lower levels of resilience among poor blue-collar whites at this juncture, which is poor minorities have kind of had to move away from their expectations, or they started with lower expectations and by definition have had to multitask and take whatever job or whatever it might be or move, particularly if they're migrants, to make things work versus poor whites, poor blue-collar whites, who have traditionally been very hardworking. It's not about their work ethic, but they haven't had kind of instability in what their trajectory was. You know, your dad was a coal miner, you're going to be a coal miner, or whatever it might be. And that was sort of and you worked hard, and that was your path towards kind of middle class stability. That isn't there anymore, and yet you don't have a past history of locational mobility, of multitasking, of taking on different kinds of jobs. And your aspirations path has sort of been set for a long time, and all of a sudden that's been shaken up. And how do you shift gears? I don't think any of us have the answer, but I think it's something we, you know, sort of it's part of this whole crisis of despair need to be thinking about a lot.
Does any of this disparity in outcomes, or at least attitudes of Americans, poor Americans of color versus poor white Americans, does it feed into an attitude of racial tension among these groups?
Yes, to be blunt, and it has not been in any way helped by the current political climate that has sort of fed that beast. Unfortunately, and there's a, you know, it's a conundrum because as you see a lot more desperation among poor and uneducated whites and middle class, lower middle class whites, you realize there is real despair, there is real fear, there are actual losses in terms of employment and other things, but the last solution you want is people beating drums about, you know, trying to increase racist sentiments. And then associated with that, I think, you know, if you 20 years ago were a young black male caught with crack in the cities, you were tossed into jail very quickly. And it was sort of when the drug epidemic was black, it was a crime. Now with opioids, it's whites, and it's a health crisis. So, I mean, that's kind of cynical interpretation, let's say. But it is, you know, it is telling that there, you know, there's also now a temptation to sort of shift all our attention to the plight of poor whites. And poor minorities still face significant challenges. And I would say in the past, since the onset of the Trump administration, increasing likelihood of racial tension.
Carol Graham is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and College Park professor at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. You can find a link to her recent report for Brookings, The Geography of Desperation in America, at think.kera.org. Carol, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thanks, Chris. It was a really enjoyable show.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook and also on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @KERAThink. You can find the podcast anywhere you find podcasts. And you can also learn more about upcoming shows if you go to think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.